This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
For those of us living in North America, reports of sexual violence is an everyday reality. There are stories from Steubenville, Ohio to Halifax, Nova Scotia. The stories involve athletes, media personalities, and celebrities. Discussions and arguments about the prevalence of sexual violence and its impact on society abound all over the nightly news and social media. Often the conversations include one stark phrase, rape culture. Kate Harding is an author and columnist. Her most recent book is titled Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Harding's book takes a long, hard look at Western society's attitude towards rape and suggests myriad ways to change it. And Kate Harding joins me by phone this morning. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Jane.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you say that the term rape culture has actually been around since at least the 1970s. Yet it seems to be having a moment right now. Why is that?
I think that we're seeing so much of it in the news now, and with social media, the way that that can amplify things and make national stories or even international stories out of things that might have been hyper-local before, it really kind of reveals how this all works together as a system and actually as a culture. So, you know, that phrase rape culture sounds really counterintuitive when you first hear it because you think, nobody is pro-rape, you know, we can't possibly have a culture that condones rape. But when you really see how we treat so many individual rape cases and how it's so similar no matter where it's happening or when it's happening, you start to see that there is a culture here that is really blaming the victim and supporting the needs of the rapist more than the victim.
It is a very in-your-face kind of term.
I reacted strongly to it when I first heard it, too, and I thought it was ridiculous. But it's something, you know, it's one of those things I think that there are lots of words that come from kind of the academic world where they sound strange to those of us who aren't in that world. But then once you learn about it, you realize, oh, you're really putting a name to something that needed a name.
Why did you decide to write this book at this particular time?
You know, I actually sold the proposal for the book 3 years ago now, and that was when I was really just getting fed up with seeing so many things in the news. That was about when the Steubenville news was breaking and that sort of thing, and we'd had all of these politicians saying just absolutely ridiculous things about rape here in the States, and I really felt like there was something that all of the feminists that I knew were understanding about the way we talked about this that just wasn't in the mainstream conversation. And I wanted to write a book that could help make that translation from kind of the feminist world to the mainstream so that people could understand what we're talking about and not just balk at that very in-your-face phrase, but actually understand what is meant by rape culture and why the way we talk about it so often in the media, in our schools, in our communities, is really actually pretty damaging.
Now, the first section of the book is titled Slut Shaming, Victim Blaming, and Rape Myths. What do you think it is about rape that makes us want to blame the victim?
I think it's a couple of things. You know, for one thing, I think for women, it makes us feel a little bit safer sometimes if we can say that, oh, if she hadn't gone there, if she hadn't done that, dressed that way, walked alone at night, etc., then she wouldn't have been raped, and that means I won't be raped either if I don't do those things. And then I think we also have a problem with being encouraged to really identify with the perpetrator and not the victim where this crime is concerned. And I think it's something that even though men are raped and men are, in fact, more likely to be raped than to be falsely accused of rape, there is this enormous fear among men of being falsely accused, of being powerless to do anything about it. And so they will often give the rapist the benefit of the doubt And that means looking for a reason to blame the victim, essentially, or to say that she was, either she was asking for it or it didn't really happen, she's lying, et cetera, you know, anything that makes it so that we don't have to actually hold the perpetrator accountable, because that is very scary.
I imagine that that very high level of blaming the victim, or that desire to blame the victim, must have a tremendous impact when cases come to court.
Absolutely. I mean, even before it makes it to court, because it's one of the most underreported crimes. It's terribly underreported, and that's because victims know that there's a good chance that they'll be, you know, no one will believe them, or even if they are believed, they'll be interrogated themselves, treated as criminals themselves, essentially, as the case is investigated. And then when it gets to court, you know, I have a friend who has told me he's feeling really haunted after reading this book, because he was a juror on a rape trial years ago, and the jury essentially believed that the guy did it, but because it came down to one person's word against the other, that was automatic reasonable doubt in their case. And so that becomes a big problem, and especially then if you have people buying into the myths and the stereotypes about rape, that they're just going to find a way to, again, avoid holding that person accountable when the only evidence against him is someone else's word.
Now, you've said in a recent interview that righteous fury helped you to write the book. Can you tell me a little bit about that process?
Well, you know, when I was starting, this is the first book that I've written completely by myself, so the process was very much just winging it and seeing how it worked out. But it was kind of grueling at times. I mean, this is very dark subject matter, and even though I tried to treat it with, you know, some levity where I could, and to infuse a real sense of, you know, anger and purpose instead of just despair and hopelessness, it was hard, and I had to take breaks sometimes, but what would get me back would I would just be so angry that we're still making all of the same mistakes, that we're still blaming victims, that we're still refusing to hold perpetrators accountable, and that would just get me back on the horse, and I could just, you know, ride my fury for another chapter.
Now, in the face of such a dark, disturbing topic, as you say, you use levity, you use humor, sarcasm. Was that your intention when you first started putting the book together?
Definitely. I mean, you know, that's a lot of that is sort of my signature voice as a writer, and the publisher knew that when they took me on. But part of it is also because I feel like with this subject, what I'm trying to convey is not, you know, here is your rape culture 101, here's how it works, but that these things should be obvious to us by now, that it's kind of ridiculous that we aren't handling this better after at least 40 years of feminist scholarship on the subject, after talking about it. I came of age in the 90s, and there was a conversation about it then that then just kind of dropped off, and there was a backlash. So I'm really coming at it from the approach of, like, are you kidding me? We're still doing this. We're still like this about the subject. And so that sort of lent itself to some of that kind of sarcasm and a little bit of snark, without, you know, trying to diminish the seriousness of the subject.
In that spirit of, are you kidding me, do you see any reasons for hope?
I do. You know, I think that the biggest thing for me is that I feel like young people today are kind of doing amazing things in terms of activism and connecting with each other on social media. I think that the college activists on this subject are doing incredible things. Here in the States, you know, one of the big things that's changing is that under Title IX, which everybody thinks of as the thing that, you know, got women's sports equality at the college level, it's actually supposed to be about freedom from sexual discrimination. And now colleges are under investigation for whether they are doing everything they can to reasonably prevent rape on campus as a potential Title IX violation. And that's all the work of student activists. That amazes me. And then just, I think, again, social media is such a wonderful way for people to connect, and it's something that really breaks down one of the biggest barriers, I think, that exists for victims and survivors is the sense of isolation, the sense that no one will believe me, the sense that I don't have anyone I can talk to or tell about this, and I think that the Internet makes it so you can go and find those people who will listen and believe you and help you much more easily than you could even 20 years ago.
What do you hope that people reading the book will take away from it?
I hope that they will recognize that this is a systematic problem, that it doesn't come down to any individual person saying, oh, rape is okay, who cares, but just all of these little things in the aggregate create a system that makes it very, very hard on victims and actually makes it very easy for rapists to get away with it and unlikely that they will ever be successfully prosecuted. So being able to recognize, again, how it works as this kind of web of interconnected systems and institutions that create something that really is identifiable as a rape culture.
Thank you very much for talking with me this morning, Kate, and thank you for writing the book.
Thank you so much, Jane.
I've been speaking with Kate Harding. She's an author and columnist. Her new book is called Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It.